Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salia Report James Turk, who's been with us many times before. James had a very successful career in banking and all things money, and then finally, in despair over the sort of unsoundness of the currency and financial systems, developed a very successful product and mechanisms to introduce digital gold and launched goldmoney.com about 10 years ago, which of course has been very successful and many of our subscribers are familiar with it. And James continues to be a voice in the wilderness, not so much in the wilderness anymore, moving directly into the mainstream for financial freedom and the importance of financial freedom and all the different aspects of it as it touches our lives. So James, I know you're coming from London, so thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Salieri Report.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for the invitation. It's always great to be with you.
Well, you know, I have a most ambitious first question, which, of course, since April 2011, will we ever forget the month? You know, we've seen gold consolidate, the price of gold consolidating down. And I'm most curious to get your take on what you think has happened with global gold and precious metal inventories since then, and sort of where the state of the international inventories is outside of your vaults, of course, today.
Yeah, all the gold and gold money is there where it's supposed to be and audited and everything else. But a lot of the other vaults around the world, particularly here in England, in London, they've been emptied with the metal flowing from Europe over to Asia. You know, there's a voracious appetite by the Chinese in particular, but also the Indians, acquiring physical metal. And, you know, they understand the difference between physical gold and paper gold. You know, they buy the metal not to try to profit from fluctuations in its price, but because they want a tangible asset that doesn't have counterparty risk. You know, a liquid asset, the only form of money that's not based on someone's promise.
Right.
Over the last few years, we've seen this metal is just flowing out of European vaults over to Asia.
And how much do you think that this can continue? How long can it continue?
Well, you know, I don't think it could continue as long as it has continued. You know, I've looked at a number of different things. But the problem with the gold market, particularly the physical side of the market, it's very opaque. You know, most of the trading is done off exchange, so there's very little reporting as to what's happening. Movements of metal are generally done without announcements because of security reasons and things of that nature. So there's only limited information that you can look at as to how the metal is moving, but you can see the export data from the UK, the export data from Switzerland, et cetera. But the thing that I look at most closely is the price of gold itself, both in the spot market and the forward market. You're looking anywhere from 2 weeks or 4 weeks forward into the future and comparing the two. Gold should normally trade in what's called contango. The forward price should always be above the spot price. But since since January 2013, gold has been basically in backwardation. In other words, the spot price is above the forward price. This is an abnormal occurrence, and it basically suggests that there's very little physical metal to come into the market to take advantage of that arbitrage. In other words, if you have physical metal today, you could sell it at spot and buy it back in the future at a lower price. But
right.
It involves counterparty risk, and not everybody wants to do that. But the fact that this backwardation has persisted as long as it has suggests to me that there's a shortage of physical metal in the London market. And that's, I think, something that is a strong indication that it ultimately has to be the price of gold ultimately has to go higher. And the reason is that mines cannot increase production by a significant amount to satisfy the physical demand. The physical demand can only come from existing above-ground stocks, and it's going to take a much higher price to entice people to part with their physical metal and accept a national currency instead. So basically what I'm saying is gold is very undervalued here, and I think the way the market is trading is a good indication of that.
Well, you know, we've seen it break the 1200 line many times and then always come back. It seems to hold that line so far.
Yeah, the central banks and the central planners, I think, have pretty much drawn the line in the sand at that level. They're trying to keep, you know, gold below that level so as not to have a red flag waving that, you know, not everything is working the way they want it to work in the international financial system. You know, there are problems all over the place, particularly Greece. And as a consequence, the last thing the central planners want is for the price of gold to be rising, because when it does rise, that's a signal that people should be looking at what's going on in the monetary system, and that tends to increase the demand for gold and cause it to go even higher.
Well, you're over there in London. What do you think is going to happen with Greece? Because things are really coming to a head at this point.
Yeah, you know, people have been talking about what they call a Grexit, the Greece exit from the euro. I'm saying that what people should be looking at is a Grefault, a Greece default on its debt. It's not easy for Greece to actually leave the eurozone. All of the members of the eurozone have to agree to it, including Greece itself. And it's quite clear that Greece wants to remain in the euro and remain in the eurozone and use the euro as its currency. So I don't think we're going to see any Grexit, but I think we are going to see a Grefault. In other words, Greece has too much debt, far beyond its financial capacity to service that debt, so they're going to default on that debt. Now, the interesting thing, Catherine, is that, you know, Greece has defaulted several times throughout history on its foreign debt. And in the past, what's happened is the debt was denominated in drachma, you know, the local currency.
Right.
And they just continued to print drachma to ultimately debase the currency and therefore lower the burden of the debt. Now, this time around, the debt is actually denominated in euros, and they don't have the ability to print euros to infinity because the European Central Bank controls how many euros will be can be printed at any moment in time. So they can't default on the debt by debasing the currency. They can only default on the debt by saying they're not going to repay it. And I think that's where we're headed. Now, the implications are they've got about 320 billion at last count euros worth, 320 billion euros worth of debt. Now, a lot of this debt, when the Greece crisis first hit back in 2010, was in the hands of private banks. But over the past few years, that debt has moved from private banks into public hands, the EU itself, EU governments, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. So these governmental institutions, which are going to have to take the hit on this loss when Greece defaults on its debt, and that means basically banks come out okay, but taxpayers are going to have to pay for the loss on these debts that Greece has incurred.
We just did a big review of planetary debt, both sovereign and private, for the first quarter wrap-up. It was called Planet Debt. And one of the things that you see throughout the world, with rare exception, is the last – first of all, global debt has doubled since 2005. And what we did during the 2008-2012 period was simply take a whole – enormous amount of debt and move it out of private balance sheets into governmental balance sheets. And we now have 39 countries with GDP, debt to GDP ratio over 100%. But what's interesting about it, James, is just as you pointed out, it divides up between people who are borrowing in their own currency and people who are borrowing in somebody else's currency. And it's a very different picture. If you're borrowing, the quote we used was from Alan Greenspan, the United States can't default, it can just print more money. It's kind of an honest moment. Right. So we're really watching a divergence between those who can print and those who can't to cover their debt. And it's almost a, you know, I almost, when I finished writing it, I thought maybe I should call this Planet Entrapment.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because I don't.
Another thing.
Go ahead.
There's another thing related to this debt. And that's the negative interest rates that we are seeing over here in Europe. There's something like 1.5 trillion euros of negative interest rates. In other words, people are paying the German government, for example, to take their money for 5 years rather than earning interest income. You know, they're destroying their own capital that way,
right.
Not to mention all of the risks they have associated with it. But what this does, these negative interest rates, and just generally the low interest rate or zero interest policy being followed by central banks around the world, it helps to make governments look solvent when, in fact, they're not. You know, if they're not paying interest on the debt, the interest expense part of the government budget deficits are relatively inconsequential. If they're actually paying a fair rate of interest, these governments would be incurring even bigger deficits, which would cause them to borrow even more, which would cause interest rates to rise, which would cause them to borrow more, and you eventually get into the hyperinflationary scenario where the currency is destroyed. So, I mean, it's absolutely a mess, totally unprecedented in terms of the way these debt levels are being handled, but not unprecedented in the sense that we've seen this before many times throughout monetary history, where governments take on too much debt, and eventually that debt just gets defaulted upon and never repaid.
Well, here's what the one of the things I wrote about in Planet Debt was the fact that we have something new, and that is we've created very invasive digital systems through phones, through internet, through TV, through all sorts of vehicles. And what that is allowing us to do in combination with relational database technology and artificial intelligence is if you look at the economic hit games that we ran on sovereign nations once upon a time, we can now run those on an individual level and make money targeting economic hits on people with very modest incomes all the way up. And so, you know, we're now looking at machinery that can entrap, you know, it can make more money from people's failure than from their success, both at the individual level, at the municipal level, and the national level. You know, because you move in and the players that move in with the debt, you can write off the debt or stick it on the, you know, in bailouts to the government, but you're picking up the equity cheap as you go. You know, so it's really an economic hit operation. And my concern is that, you know, there's a portion, there's a whole portion of the debt market, which is, you know, lenders and borrowers doing business, but there's a whole nother portion that's really an entrapment game. And that entrapment game can keep going because, in fact, it's set up to make more money from failure than from success. And And that's kind of, so it keeps bringing me back to who's in control and how do we switch?
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
You know, this is interesting as it relates to Greece because, I'm sure the people in Greece feel that they're trapped and they're trying to break that cycle. But you, on one side, you have the so-called troika, the EU, the IMF, and the ECB fighting you know, the Greeks and trying to keep them in that that level of entrapment. So it's a question of whether or not, you know, Greece honors its debt or doesn't honor its debt. And even if Greece accepts the bailout, all they're doing is just borrowing more money from the troika to just repay debts to the troika to maintain the illusion that these debts are actually serviceable when, in fact, we know that they're not serviceable. But that illusion basically enables the various parties in the troika to continue carrying these assets on their books as if they have value rather than being with us, which is essentially what the real state of affairs are for those debts.
Well, one of the questions is whether the political process can use law to abrogate some of the debts or to bust them. Because if you look at the conditions under which some of the debts around the world have been issued. So I would say after 1996, most mortgages in this country violated the fundamental laws of origination. So they violated disclosure and all sorts of other things. So there's fraudulent inducement. You know, the other thing I've said is, look, there's $4 trillion missing from the federal government. Let's just make a list of all the people and banks who run the payment systems and, you know, assert common law right of offset and get our $4 trillion back by, you know, by matching it up against debts and tearing up those $4 trillion of debt. So, I mean, there are legal mechanisms to go back, but I think the, you know, doing it has got to look at the system as fundamentally illegitimate, which brings me to the question, you know, we've seen the Europeans go along with the U.S. in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine and financial sanctions. And I have to believe from everything, we did a great interview with John Laughlin about 2 months ago, but I have to believe those financial sanctions are really wreaking havoc with Europe's economy and making it more difficult to deal with the debt. And the question is, why are they going along?
Why is Europe going along?
Yeah.
Well, it is wrecking havoc on the European economy. And as you are probably aware, you know, the biggest energy supplier to much of Europe is, of course, Russia. So it just doesn't make economic sense, you know, in order to participate in those sanctions, particularly when you realize that, you know, Ukraine has been part of Russia longer than Texas has been part of the United States.
Right.
You know, so it doesn't make any economic sense. The only way it makes sense is that in this day and age, you know, money is no longer a neutral tool in commerce. It's now a political weapon, and financial sanctions are a political weapon. So it's only to fight a financial war. It's not to not to accomplish any meaningful, you know, economic objective.
It's funny. I don't know if I mentioned it to you many years ago. Trying to solve a related problem, I did a study of how the money worked on the Salem witch trials. And one of the things I discovered, do you know what got the Salem witch trials stopped?
No.
Somebody realized that if they all kept going to court and didn't plant, that they would starve to death. And every time I look around the world, you know, we have this growing sort of debate. Are we going to use the financial system as a weapon of war? Are we going to use the financial system to do the work of the world? And, you know, the different efforts I see by the BRIC nations to create alternative structures is because they need something to get the work done with. And the financial system isn't sufficing for the reasons we all know. And I'm just beginning to wonder, if you look at global sort of growth slowdown, both globally and here, you know, are we reaching the point that if we don't, you know, get with the program and start being a little bit more, you know, it's almost as like the whole planet is being run to centralize everything, you know, and they couldn't care less what's going on with the economy. Let it fall apart.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like that's the case. It doesn't make sense. But, you know, politicians don't necessarily do things that necessarily make sense to the man on the street. They have their own agenda, and they work to bring about their own agenda, regardless of the consequences.
Well, it's funny. The head of Luxembourg many years ago said, we know what to do. We just don't know how to get elected after we do it.
Yeah, and the other thing he said is that when it gets serious, we have to lie. And there's a lot of lying going around by government officials these days.
Right. I just recently sort of made an effort to really try to understand the financial sanctions. And we've watched the United States go to extraordinary lengths over the last 10 years, well, since 9/11, to assert legal control over financial payment systems and arrangements globally. And I know certainly being running gold money and dealing with lots of U.S. citizens and residents, you've had to deal with the compliance issues involved in that. How, you know, do you think the Americans can continue to do this and get away with it? How is the global financial system, how are financial institutions in Europe reacting? I would think there'd be more and more people looking to, you know, I see more and more people dumping U.S. citizens. They just don't want to do business with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost impossible these days for, you know, a U.S. citizen to open a bank account pretty much anywhere in the world, but particularly, you know, in Europe and major financial centers. From a perspective of a European bank or an Asian bank, Hong Kong bank, it's just not worth the effort.
Right.
Because there's just so much reporting and potential legal liability. So, there is that that kind of reaction. But there's also another reaction that I think is really a reflection of the statist view that people have, that governments have of themselves and of their importance. Because these sanctions are a way of increasing the power of the state, not the sanctions, this extraterritoriality that the U.S. government's trying to impose on the rest of the world, there are other statist governments that want to impose extraterritoriality themselves on their own citizens. So you're seeing governments working together to limit
right.
individual freedom. It's being pulled two ways here. You know, some of the institutions say, you know, we're just going to go our own way and forget about U.S. citizens. But then the governments in these countries are also trying to impose extraterritoriality as well. I guess moving toward the, a common worldwide, tax system and common worldwide reporting on taxes. Governments thinking that, that's the way that they're going to get more money in order to run the various programs and things that they want to do.
Well, it's interesting. In 2011, I had plans to spend, a significant amount of my time in Europe and Asia. And then the U.S. markets took off, and I discovered myself, here underwriting Cracker Barrel instead. And now, now I'm starting to implement what I had said I would do in 2011. So I'm headed out to Asia on Saturday. But the reports I get from clients and friends and colleagues in both Europe and Asia, I repeatedly get reports that life feels so much freer there. It's funny, I was talking to one client in China, and she just said, it's so much freer here. It just feels so much more free. You want to start a store, you just start a store. And, it's remarkable. So I'm curious to see whether you're in London. What do you think?
Yeah, it is remarkable. And, I had a similar experience. I lived many years in Abu Dhabi, in the Middle East. And people would say, well, gosh, wasn't it a terrible place to live because, controls, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, you really felt much more freer in Abu Dhabi than you do in a lot of other places of the world, in part because there was, no income tax, no import duty, no value-added tax, nothing, no government reporting, no national security agency watching what you could do and not do. It's really sort of interesting that particularly people who have not had the opportunity to live and travel abroad, they don't necessarily understand and appreciate that the system that they live in, the country where they live, and this is true for a lot of different countries, may not be as free or as open as a lot of other places in the world. And, this is particularly true of the United States, where all of the rules and regulations apply. You don't see rules and regulations like that in so many other places around the world.
Right. Well, when the year started off, James, I was very worried that if the Fed really did start to raise interest rates in June, we could get the dollar much higher and we'd get what I call a bear trap. That if you look at between 2005 or between, yeah, I think, no, 2007 and today, as I said, global debt has doubled. But coming into the bailouts, it was the developed world that was highly leveraged. What has happened since 2007 is the developing world has gotten highly leveraged. There's a recent series of studies from McKinsey on debt that were very good, and one of them said that their estimate was 35% of global growth had come from the Chinese levering up. And so now, and a lot of that levering up with dollars cheap was in the dollar. And my fear was we get sort of what I call a bear trap in the dollar. If the dollar flies up, U.S. raises interest rates, then suddenly all these guys who borrowed dollars with a global slowdown have a harder time borrowing dollars to pay back their dollars. And suddenly, the U.S. has everybody over a barrel. So that was my big fear starting January 1. And what has in fact happened was, even though the dollar's come up, it's been soft. The U.S. economy is soft. You know, there was real expectation here in the consensus view that the U.S. economy would be reasonably good. And it's not. The first quarter, when you back out inventories, it was deflating. And so the problem with throwing a bear trap is, you know, they're going to shoot themselves. So the question is, you know, with the U.S. slow, with the globe slow, you know, is the U.S. in real trouble?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, the dollar has gone up, in my view, simply because it's the best of a lot of bad choices. In other words, interest rates in the United States are near zero. You know, T-bills are near zero, but they're not negative. So a lot of capital from Europe moved over to the United States, and that strengthened the dollar. But, you know, it's now a turning, because I think the recognition is out there that the Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates. If they do, they'll raise it by a quarter of a percent to try to maintain credibility. But that's, you know, just a drop in the ocean.
Right.
You know, they've been threatening to raise interest rates going back to, you know, when Ben Bernanke first announced all of his quantitative easing programs. The criteria that they established was when the unemployment rate, you know, dropped below 6.5%, and we're well below that level, according to government statistics. But they didn't raise interest rates. And I think the reality of it is that the U.S. government cannot afford to raise interest rates. You know, the direct debt, leaving aside for a moment all of the contingent liabilities of the U.S. government, is over $18 trillion. If they raise interest rates just 1%, that's $180 billion a year. If they raise it to a fair rate of interest, you know, 5 or 6%, that's $1 trillion of additional interest expense that the U.S. government has to pay. Well, the U.S. government's revenue is only $3 trillion a year. And if they end up paying $1 trillion in interest, they're not going to cut back in $1 trillion of spending on, you know, the welfare programs or the warfare programs, you know, as the saying goes. So that means they have to borrow an extra $1 trillion. And when you're starting to borrow to pay interest, then you're definitely very, very close to the point where you get a currency collapse. So you're going to get, as we've had over the past few years, a lot of jawboning from the Federal Reserve about raising interest rates. But there's not going to be any significant increase in interest rates. And I think as a consequence of that, you're starting to see money, you know, flowing back out now of the U.S. dollar, looking for other, you know, relatively safe havens. But of course, the only real safe haven when it comes to money is, you know, physical gold or physical silver.
Well, there's another question I have, and that is, I'll never forget listening to one of my former partners from Dillon Reed tell me, he was up at First Boston running the equity desk, and telling me that the entire high volume committee at the New York Stock Exchange were so young that they'd never lived through a down market. And when you look at the book, you know, most the derivative book at this point is pretty significant, and but the vast majority of it is interest rate swaps. And as a civilization, we've never lived through a rising interest rate environment managing that size of interest rate swaps.
Yeah.
And I have no idea. Sorry, go ahead.
It is pretty scary. And I do put a lot of, you know, credence in that comment about having something in your living memory. You know, I've seen it in my own lifetime, for example, dealing with bankers in the 1970s who had in their living memory, you know, the monetary problems in Europe at the end of the Second World War.
Right.
That was clearly very much in the minds of, for example, of the people who ran the Bundesbank in the 1970s or the Swiss National Bank in the 1970s. But, you know, today you've got a younger generation who didn't experience that the monetary turmoil at the end of the Second World War. And they're more interested in other objectives, you know, being part of the club, which is what they call the euro area here now, rather than maintaining sound money. And I think, you know, that's ultimately a very serious problem, because the only way humankind advances is by interacting with one another in the marketplace. And the best way to do that is if you have a level playing field, And sound money is important to having a level playing field. And we've moved so far away from that, Catherine, that, you know, not only do we have to worry about issues such as the huge derivatives mountain that is out there, but even just basic elements that the money system itself has become so corrupt and so imbalanced that it's not surprising that economic activity is in the doldrums, because you can't have sound economic activity with bad money.
Well, you can't, and you can't have it without markets. I mean, in the United States, it's very difficult to find a real market. Because when you have this many laws and regulations, it, you know, everything is being organized. We're now in the point where the federal government is mandating, is passing laws requiring customers to buy things they don't need or want.
Yeah, back in 2008, Chris Powell of GATA came up with this comment that we don't have markets anymore, we only have interventions.
Right.
That's so true. That's so true that, you know, governments believe that they can just intervene in the market to bring about whatever kind of financial end they want to achieve. But that's not the way, you know, markets work and markets operate. What's happening is they're destroying markets. And if you destroy the markets, you're ultimately destroying capitalism. It's just like having negative interest rates is destroying capitalism, or destroying capital. And, you know, capital is too precious. It's not something that should be destroyed in that way.
Right, but I, you know, I don't actually, I believe in essence there is no government. But if you look at the people who pull the strings behind the government, to the extent that I've had any experience with them, I think they feel much more comfortable with forced monopolies. And so you're trying to organize, if you look at what's happening in healthcare and education here, you're trying to standardize human beings and their treatment in a way that you can re-engineer everything into the software and online systems and basically create forced monopolies. And, you know, as you centralize political or economic power, you lower productivity, and the productivity gets lower and lower. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Fed thought we were going to get a bounce, just because if you look at the recovery lines coming out of, you know, recessions, we're way below the historical recovery line. And they don't begin to understand, you know, they keep thinking that the thing is going to bounce, and they don't understand you've about killed all the bounce left. It can't bounce because you've done stolen, killed it, destroyed it. And if you look at the polls on institutional credibility, they're completely in the basement here in the United States. So nobody wants to be. Nobody wants to be the victim in the next entrapment. You know, it's not a market; it's an entrapment.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And you know, to think that the Federal Reserve can make decisions that, you know, are in the best interest of the economy is just totally bizarre. I mean, you have to recognize the Federal Reserve for what it is. It's no different than the Politburo in the old Soviet Union, you know, trying to determine, you know, what should be produced and what shouldn't be produced. But here you have the Federal Reserve affecting the most important element of a capitalist society, which is, of course, interest rates and the rate at which people can lend and borrow money. So it's, again, it's not too surprising that we see, you know, very tepid economic activity. And in fact, I'm not even sure the economy is even growing. You know, there's so many people now looking for work, even though it's not shown in the unemployment numbers, that the U.S. economy particularly, but also here in Europe, you know, the economic activity, I think we're already in, you know, what could be called a recession. And the numbers, even by government own statistics, are basically, you know, showing that. The only reason why they still show some growth is they say the inflation rate is a lot lower than what it really is.
Right. If you back out, if you take the U.S. statistics for the first quarter and you back out the growth in inventories, we deflated. So, yeah, but here's what I do see, you know, because I think it's very spotty. I call it global 2.0 and 3.0. 2.0 is the industrial economy, and 3.0 is the, you know, the highly centralized network economy. And in areas where 3.0 is strong, you know, things are going gangbusters and the market's tight. You know, there are places in 2.0 which are doing very poorly. And then, of course, throughout America, we've got areas where, you know, there's no manufacturing, no gas and oil, and no water, and they're just living on government subsidies. So, because most of the agriculture has gone to Latin America, it's just sort of big ag subsidy. Anyway, so I'm with you. I just think we keep draining productivity to centralize, but at some point you can't keep draining productivity without a major shift, and that includes collapses in different kinds of sectors. So it's going to be, I think this year is going to be very, very interesting. What do you think is going to happen with the tensions over the Ukraine and Russia? Do you have any sense of where you think the Russians are going and what they're going to do?
Well, I think the Russians have been pretty, subdued in their response and the provocations that are being imposed on them, by the Europeans and the Americans in terms of financial sanctions and whatnot. But, you know, again, you have to look at the politics of this. You know, the Russian Federation, Ukraine has been part of that, you know, going back hundreds of years. I think, you know, going back to the 1600s. And in Eastern Ukraine anyway, the origins are basically, you know, Russian people. The only reason why Ukraine has a separate identity is when Khrushchev was the premier, on something like the 300th birthday of the Russian-Ukraine treaty. He basically, you know, gave Ukraine independent status within the Russian, you know, Federation, or at that time the Soviet Union, because Khrushchev himself was of Ukrainian descent.
Right.
I'm sure he didn't consider the political implications, you know, 60, 70 years later as to what would happen when he did that. But I don't see. It could go. Hopefully it's going to end peacefully, but I don't see how it could. I think that the Eastern Ukraine is ultimately going to claim that it is a separate, independent state, and probably rightly so, because they have more affiliation with Russia than they do with Ukraine. It's, you know, Russian language speaking, Russian ancestry, geographically right next to Russia. And again, it's just one of these arbitrary borders that have been drawn up in conference room rather than looking at what's really actually, you know, existing on the ground.
Right.
So it could turn into a Balkan situation like we had years ago, where people were fighting over these imaginary boundary lines.
Okay, last question. The move to control cash. We've seen more and more announcements here of, you know, JP Morgan Chase not wanting cash in the in their safe deposit box. We have real, you know, I've been getting feedback from business people for years that the banks are making it more difficult to get cash or to do various things with cash. I have a great bank. I have no problems whatsoever. But I'm curious, because obviously gold money is one of the things people choose to, you know, to help avoid those kinds of scenarios. What do you see both U.S. and globally in terms of cash controls?
I think you're going to see more and more, not just cash controls, but capital controls. You know, more and more restrictions on people's freedom, more and more restrictions on people's right to do what they want with their property, meaning, you know, their purchasing power. However that purchasing power is expressed, whether it's expressed in terms of gold or whether it's expressed in terms of dollars, euros, or any other currency. You know, that's the trend that's clearly underway. But, you know, I'm not a pessimist. I am an optimist, because people or the market are always more clever than governments themselves. And if there are restrictions on people's willingness or desire to do something imposed by government, people will find ways to get around it. And, you know, that's how we humans advance. We come up with creative ideas. And
right.
So my view of digital currencies, things like cryptocurrencies, I think this is going to be a big deal. And I don't think it's something that governments are going to be able to control simply because of the technology that's available. To control cryptocurrencies, you have to essentially close down the internet. And you know, internet has become so important to governments themselves. I don't see how that can happen.
How I assume you're watching the evolution of the SDR system at the IMF for the different steps that the BRIC nations are taking individually or collectively to kind of build ways of transacting that serve the global economy. Where do you see gold's role emerging in those arrangements?
Yeah, I think you really have to look at it from the perspective that gold has a 5,000-year history. In 1971, when President Nixon broke the official link to gold, he told Treasury Secretary Connolly to suspend temporarily, that's a quote, suspend temporarily the dollar's link to gold. You know, even he understood that, you know, gold had a critical role to play.
Right.
40 years is a long time in anyone's, you know, life. You know, it's everybody's working adult lifetime. But it was in the context of gold's 5,000-year history. These 40 years are just a blink of an eye.
Right.
My view is that as a consequence, you know, people are going to understand that the attributes that made gold as money in the first place, you know, these attributes that were chosen by individuals participating, interacting in society with other individuals, the market made gold as money, and those attributes are still there. They've only been ignored or forgotten. They haven't been lost or destroyed. So as this craziness of this fiat money system that we've been operating in since 1971 comes to its conclusion, gold will go back to its rightful and traditional role at the center of global commerce. To me, that seems quite clear. When it's going to happen, you know, nobody can predict the future. But it seems quite clear that, you know, people will once again, you know, choose gold. Governments will either go back to it willingly, or they're going to be forced to go back to it because of, you know, the market itself and the collapse.
Aren't central banks adding globally? Aren't central bank stores of gold going up?
Yeah,
globally, I thought.
Again, the information is so
unreliable,
difficult
right.
to come by. Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's quite clear that the BRIC nations are accumulating gold, and the Western central banks have been taking gold out of the vault and sending it to the BRIC nations. So,
right.
you know, the fact that Russia and China are forming an economic bloc, the fact that they're creating a international payments mechanism to operate outside of SWIFT, which is the U.S. dominated international global payment system, and the fact that
i.e. beyond the reach of all sanctions.
Yeah, that's it. They want to operate free. They don't want to operate under the thumb of U.S. government authorities,
right.
and they want to be able to operate their own system and do it their own way. And it's sort of a natural reaction. People don't want to be told what to do by other people. As long as you're not doing harm, why can't people do what they want to do?
Let me ask you a question. Whether currency, if you look at the Anglo-American Alliance, it was our bond and stock markets, you know, London, New York, that have really dominated for a long, long time, James. And, you know, if you look at how we started off, you know, came out of World War II and grew it, by the time London deregulated, those markets were pretty broad and pretty deep, and the world went through them. To what extent have we just killed the goose that laid the golden egg because those markets are now seen as traps as opposed to access to liquidity?
Yeah. You know, money is power, and by controlling money, you have a lot of power. And it goes back to many years, as you're saying, which is really the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. And the system that they constructed. Now, it worked pretty well for the first couple hundred years because there were constraints on what governments could do, what central banks could do, because everybody followed the rules of the classical gold standard, which was, you know, Sir Isaac Newton's greatest invention, in my view. But banks and governments realized that these rules were voluntary and they could go their own way and not follow those rules. But what they didn't consider is that by not following the rules of the classical gold standard and not using gold as money, you're ultimately going to have consequences that are unfavorable. You know, too much debt, unsustainable levels of debt, and all kinds of crazy extensions of credit, which is essentially what derivatives are. So we have a reckoning, I think, coming. You know, I thought 2008 was finally it, but it, you know, they managed to keep it going a little bit longer. And even here, they've managed to keep this reckoning a little bit longer by having negative interest rates. But it can't go much longer, in my view, because at the end of the day, these debts that are being carried around the world have to be repaid. They're either going to be repaid by the borrower or they're going to be paid by the lender in the sense that the lender doesn't get his money back.
Right.
It's got to be reconciled one way or the other, and I think it's going to come soon. And I think this year is a very interesting one because we were talking about, you were mentioning earlier about the IMF. The special drawing rights of the IMF are being reconstructed this year, and we'll see what the Chinese have to say.
When is the announcement expected?
Well, they started work on it already, but the announcement's not supposed to take place until September or October. So that's the time frame I'm focusing on, and it should be quite interesting to see how things.
Yeah, I think that could make September. I don't know if you realize October 1 is when the new budget goes into place.
Yeah.
In the federal government, so we always have very crazy things going on. It's like the rutting season in Washington. I used to always say, "I want to get out of town for October." So between the next round of the budgets, especially coming into a presidential election, and the push to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed, plus the SDR system, I just think this fall could get really, really wild. Now, before we close, so take a look at your calendar and make sure you're in the right place. I'll be in the Netherlands. In fact, I'll be in Switzerland. I may come over to London and see you. Are you going to be there in the fall?
Yeah, I'll be here in London.
Okay. Anyway, so before we close, I just want to mention that there have been, I don't know, 5 or 10 major intellectual moments that changed my life. You know, where suddenly you see the world one way and somebody does something that is so insightful, so profoundly insightful, the bell rings, and from then on, your paradigm shifts, your framework of looking at the world is entirely different. Everything gets clear. It's moments of great coherency. And one of the moments of my life, one of the, certainly in the top five, was I was sitting in London listening to the first time I ever heard you speak, and you said the word central banking warfare model, and you explained it. And everything shifted, and I said, oh, my God, that's it. That's it. That's how the whole – that's the model. And the problem is it's – you know, when you have to change an entire planetary investment model, that's a big, deep change. And for many years I used to always say, give you credit for the central banking warfare model, and then it got so long on the radio show I just gave up. But I just want to acknowledge now that was entirely your – brilliance that has really made my intellectual life much more simple and much more insightful and much more accurate.
Thank you. So, thank you for that. You know, people call gold, or, you know, central banks call gold the barbarous relic. But the reality is that central banking is the barbarous relic.
Well, you know, I really believed that we would come through the bailouts, and once they'd use fiat currency to steal everything, they'd want to flip to sound currency because that's how you keep what you stole. So it made perfect sense to me that probably on a wholesale basis, gold would emerge as the basis of the next currency, and they'd probably use the BRICS to push it. Now, maybe that scenario can come true. I don't know. But when I did the planet debt analysis, I said, oh, no, what if they just want to keep us on a permanent fiat currency basis and just entrap. Oh, Lord, that would just be like, you know, dying in a vat of saltwater taffy. So I don't know. We have to see what happens.
Yeah, we do. But remember, we humans always continue to progress. We come, we work our way around barriers. We climb over hurdles. We continue to move forward. We don't move forward in a straight line. And there are always obstacles and things that we have to work around. But we continue to move forward with the consequence that our living standards continue to rise. And I think that's, you know, driven by technology principally, but, you know, human nature itself. And so I'm, despite all of the problems we have, I am an optimist. And I think, you know, my children and grandchildren are going to live in a better world.
Yeah, no, I'm an optimist too. It's just that we really have to get beyond fiat currency.
Yeah, I agree. That is a big obstacle.
Yeah. Okay, well, the central banking warfare model is not going to last. We need a new model, and so we look forward to being part of inventing it and watching it come out, whatever way it does. So, James, anyway, thank you for a wonderful discussion. And we just hope you have a wonderful spring, and we'll be talking to you later this year.
Great. Thanks, Catherine.
Bye. Thanks again, James. That was great. When are you coming stateside?
I'll be there in, let's see, middle of July to the 23rd of August. I think it's the 13th of July to the 23rd of August. If you're going to be up in Jackson or driving by, let us know.
I definitely will. I probably will not this year, but I will be in Europe in the fall, so we'll just see how things go.